This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 13, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The third and final presidential debate takes place tonight. We look at the issues that won't be addressed. Audio surfaces from the cockpit of a US fighter plane bombing innocent people in Fallujah. And in our continuing election countdown series, today we look at the effect the Cuban vote in Florida could have on the election. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A Palestinian schoolgirl who was shot by Israeli gunfire as she sat inside a United Nations school in Gaza has died from her injuries. Leila El-Haddad reports from Gaza.
9-year-old Ghadir Jaber Muhaymar was sitting in her classroom in the United Nations-flagged Khalidiyah school in the Khan Yunis refugee camp when an Israeli sniper opened fire from a nearby Jewish settlement, injuring her seriously in the chest. She later died in the hospital's ICU. Israeli forces say they were responding to Palestinian fire from the area. It is the fourth such incident in under 2 years, according to the United Nations Public Information Officer Paul McCann. Just last month, 10-year-old Raghda Al-Assad was struck in the head by an Israeli bullet while sitting at her desk in the same refugee camp. The UN says it sees this as a sign of the Israeli army's indiscriminate and dangerous military tactics in civilian areas. Over 33 children have been killed since Israeli occupation forces began their offensive in northern Gaza on September 28th. Israel has now widened the major operation by thrusting deeper into the town of Beit Lahia. The operation, codenamed Days of Penitence, is intended to thwart Palestinian rocket fire into the Israeli town of Sderot, but has so far been unsuccessful. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, I'm Leila El-Haddad.
According to the Israeli daily Haaretz, the CIA is detaining at least 11 of al-Qaeda's senior operatives at a top-secret interrogation facility in Jordan. Prisoners are being held without access to lawyers, family members, or the Red Cross. A Human Rights Watch report charges that this is in direct violation of the Geneva Convention, ratified by the United States. The detention of prisoners outside the U.S. enables the use of otherwise illegal interrogation methods. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged principal architect of the 9/11 attacks, is among those believed to be held in Jordan. Just 2 weeks before Election Day, the Maryland State Board of Elections is refusing to allow independent poll observers to monitor possible glitches with the Diebold electronic voting machines. A federal lawsuit was filed yesterday. From Hyattsville, Dolores M. Bernal has more.
True Vote Maryland is suing the State Board of Elections there for denying credentials to poll observers that would have allowed them to move freely within 100 feet of the precincts for the November election. The group is a major critic of the Diebold touchscreen voting machines, saying they leave no paper trail and can be easily tampered with. Monitoring the polls has been the last resort by True Vote and other national organizations in an effort to document problems with the voting machines. Linda Shade is True Vote Maryland's spokesperson.
It's really yet another outrage that it's even controversial that nonpartisan elections observers should have access to observe a Democratic election.
A hearing on the lawsuit may be scheduled as soon as this week. Shade says that no matter the outcome, poll observers will be present. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dolores Bernal.
The FBI has been notified that hundreds of voter registration forms have been intentionally discarded or destroyed by a private company hired by the Republican Party to sign people up to vote. Employees who worked for the Voters Outreach of America in Las Vegas allege that scores of registration forms were thrown in the garbage. According to former employees, Voters Outreach of America sought only Republican registrations. The company reportedly employed up to 300 part-time workers and collected hundreds of registrations each day. The two ex-workers say they personally witnessed company supervisors tear up and trash registration forms signed by Democrats. Similar complaints have been received in Oregon and in Reno, Nevada, where officials have asked the FBI to investigate. Today, as indie media reporters protested the FBI's confiscation of two of the network's servers, word came from the host company, Rackspace, that the servers will be back online by 5 p.m. GMT. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz has more.
A gag rule on San Antonio-based Rackspace has kept the web hosting company quiet about why the two servers located in the UK were confiscated. But this morning, their business development consultant sent a vague email to Indie Media indicating their servers would be back online by the end of the day. Indie Media says it has not yet been able to verify that all original data is on the drives. When the Swiss government sent an order last Thursday to the U.S. and U.K. that resulted in the FBI seizure of two Indie Media servers, 20 local websites from 17 countries were taken offline. Today, protesters in Amsterdam and Houston answered a global call to action on the U.K. Indie Media site to speak out against the assault on freedom of the press. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The third and final presidential debate between George W. Bush and John Kerry will take place tonight at Arizona State University. The debate will focus on domestic policies such as homeland security, the economy, jobs, and healthcare. While people in Arizona consider a proposition that immigrant rights activists say violate human rights, immigration policies are not issues the mainstream candidates have sparred over. Mitch Jeserich has this presidential debate preview.
Presidential candidates make a lot of promises.
I have a plan.
I want to make sure it cures you and doesn't kill you.
I have a plan to lower the cost of health care for you.
And I'm going to spend what it takes to win the war.
But presidents don't make laws. They sign them. Senator Kerry would unlikely be able to implement his health care plan if the GOP continues to control Congress. And President Bush would unlikely be able to reform Social Security if the Democrats gain control of either the House or Senate. Libertarian presidential candidate Michael Badnarik, who has been excluded from the debates, says as president, he would tell the people how the process really works.
First of all, I would veto any unconstitutional law that Congress sent to my desk. I would then hold a State of the Union address to let Americans know what Congress was trying to do, why it was unconstitutional, and reminding them that as president, I have very limited power.
In tonight's debate, Bob Schieffer of CBS will ask Kerry and Bush questions on domestic policy. The economy will likely take center stage. At last week's debate, Bush touted his tax cuts as stopping the recession in its tracks.
Because we cut taxes on everybody. Remember, we ran up the child credit by 1,000. We reduced the marriage penalty. We created the 10% bracket. Everybody who pays taxes got relief. The recession was one of the shortest in our nation's history.
Although the recession has ended, I don't think our economy has recovered very well or fully.
Max Sawicki is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C.
Now, the tax cuts that we got were probably better than nothing, at least for the short run, but had a very weak bang for the buck.
Also in last week's debate, Senator John Kerry looked straight into the camera and said that he would not raise taxes on the middle class, even as he says in 4 years he'll cut the mammoth $400 billion deficit by half.
I'm pledging I will not raise taxes. I'm giving a tax cut to the people earning less than $200,000 a year.
If John Kerry thinks he's going to balance the budget and not raise taxes on people, on anyone making less than $200,000 a year, he's just dead wrong.
Again, economist Max Sawicki.
I don't think we should balance the budget. We need to get the deficit under control. Right now, debt is growing much too fast. But in order to fix that, there will have to be tax increases, and they will have to cover more people than just the top 2% of taxpayers. So in that respect, Kerry reflects a delusion about the shape of the budget.
While tonight's debate will be held in the southwest state of Arizona, it's unlikely the candidates will spend much time on immigration, even though this November, people in Arizona will be voting on Proposition 200, which would require all state employees, including police officers, school teachers, and emergency room staff, to report undocumented immigrants to the INS. Kat Rodriguez is with the Immigrant Rights Group in Arizona, the Coalition for Derechos Humanos.
The children that are going to be affected because parents are going to be afraid to take them in for immunizations. They're going to be afraid to take them into the hospital for things that they, you know, would be able to get. They're less likely to come forward and say that they witness a crime. You know, your school teacher is now also possibly someone that's got to turn you in or face a class 2 misdemeanor, you know, and and get a fine on him or her herself. So I mean, it creates division. It creates people with this suspicious thing of looking at each other and are you and is it my job and do I have to? I could get in trouble if I don't.
Rodriguez says she's disappointed that neither of the major candidates has taken a strong stand in finding ways to legalize some 10 million undocumented workers in the U.S. Though all of Arizona's congressional delegation opposes Prop 200, it is comfortably leading in the polls. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
The Supreme Court heard oral arguments today on cases dealing with immigration law and the death penalty. Debate before the High Court asked justices to consider world opinion when deliberating the constitutionality of juvenile death penalty cases. And in one of three immigration cases to be heard this week, the court was asked to decide whether the government can send immigrants back to countries that haven't agreed to accept them. Jenny Johnson files this report.
22 juvenile offenders have been executed in the United States since 1972, while 84 are currently on death row. The court will look at whether evolving standards of decency in American society consider the execution of juveniles to be cruel and unusual punishment. The case at issue deals with a heinous murder committed by a 17-year-old Christopher Simmons in 1993. A Missouri court sentenced Simmons to death. According to new scientific studies of the development of the brain, the ban on executions of juveniles under 16 should be extended to juveniles through 18 years of age, according to Joseph McLaughlin, an attorney who wrote a brief for the American Medical Association and other groups.
It develops starting with the most basic part of the brain, which is the sort of prehistoric part of the brain, if you will. It tells us to run away from danger or to fight. But the cognitive part of the brain develop later in life. These studies have confirmed that it's after 18, in what I would view as, late adolescence, early adulthood, that the brain begins to mature to a point where you can expect an adult level of behavior from someone.
The U.S. is in company with only Iran and the Republic of Congo in officially sanctioning the execution of juveniles. Based on his experience over the past 20 years in death penalty cases, the subgroup of teenagers who are committing such crimes deserve to be treated more sensitively, McLaughlin argues.
Virtually all of them came from backgrounds where they were severely abused as children. Most of them had abused alcohol and drugs starting very early in their lives. Most of them had dropped out of school very young. Most of them had very abusive parents who sexually abused them.
The issue at stake in the immigration law case is whether the government has the right to indefinitely detain a class of immigrants who have never gained permanent residency or who have been stopped at the border. Since 2001, legally admitted aliens who were later ordered removed from the U.S. had to be deported or taken out of custody within 90 days. The question now is whether this provision should extend to aliens who have not gained legal admission. The case deals with Cuban refugees and the precedent of Castro releasing people from jail, encouraging them to go to Florida, and then not accepting them back into Cuba. Daniel Benitez was one such example, detained at the border and given temporary immigration parole. He then went on to commit several crimes. His attorney, John Mills, argued that after Benitez served his time in jail, it is inhumane to keep him in jail because of his immigration status.
As soon as Castro dies or we have any other way of removing them, they are immediately going to be taken out of society and removed. So they're not here free for the rest of their lives. The question is what do we do with them until there's a chance to have them leave.
Mills describes the temporary parole scenario that he is suggesting instead of indefinite detention.
They have to constantly report back where they are. If they violate their conditions, that's a separate crime. And certainly if they were to commit any other crimes, just like anybody else, they could be convicted. They're going to have very, very, very long sentences if they commit any other crimes. And that's the deterrent right there.
There are separate provisions under the Patriot Act that allow for the indefinite detention of suspected terrorists, so this case does not directly deal with that. However, Mills did draw a parallel to the Supreme Court's decision in the Hamdi case earlier this year when the court limited the power of the executive branch.
The Supreme Court said, well, no, we're going to defer to you a lot, but at the end of the day, we're not going to just trust you. And I think it's a scary time when our government asserts the right to put somebody in jail for the rest of their life without any judicial process.
Jenny Johnson, Free Speech Radio News.
The results of the first scientific exhumation of mass graves in Iraq are discovering hundreds of bodies which US investigators say they hope will help to convict Saddam Hussein of crimes against humanity. Nine trenches in a riverbed in the Hatra site in northern Iraq are reported to contain at least 300 bodies and possibly thousands, including pregnant women and toddlers still clutching toys. Meanwhile, four more US soldiers were killed today in a roadside blast in Baghdad. While in Sadr City, where that money for guns exchange is underway, there's been anger over the fact that on handing in weapons, the Iraqi police are giving vouchers instead of cash. For the latest from Baghdad, we turn to Iman Kamis, an Iraqi citizen, formerly the director of Occupation Watch.
In the last 24 hours, many attacks were done against the American vehicles and troops, and at least six soldiers were killed in Baghdad, also in Mosul, and on the way to Fallujah. And this is what we saw on the news. I mean, we don't know what exactly happened, but the attacks were on American vehicles. Actually, today, Alawi, you know, the Prime Minister Alawi threatened Fallujah that he is going to invade if they do not give Al-Zarqawi. The problem is that these people are saying, we don't know what is Al-Zarqawi, we don't know who is Al-Zarqawi, we don't know if there is any Zarqawi, etc. But the problem is that bombing is going on Fallujah, and maybe you have heard of the restaurant, popular restaurant, that was attacked, and many people were killed, and before that, the wedding. I don't know if this news reach you or not, but anyway, bombing is continuous on Fallujah, and many, many civilians are being killed, families, children, women, and we can see them on TV, you know, when they take them from under the rubble. And almost all the time, the places that are being bombed are houses, I mean, civilian houses. We don't know what happened in Samarra because all of a sudden it is quiet. You know that Samarra was surrounded for 3 months under siege, and then it was attacked and bombed. I don't know if you know the details of what happened in Samarra, of the killings of the civilians, of the hospitals that were closed, of the refugee camps, etc. The thing is that Iraqis now talk about attacks that are being bombing on different cities in Iraq, and it looks like there is a kind of a plan to bomb many Iraqi cities before the election, you know, kind of pacifying the resistance, because Samarra, Fallujah, Tal Afar, Musayyib, many, many other, also Baghdad, south of Baghdad, and there is an area near Hilla. Hilla is a city 100 kilometers south of Baghdad. They call it now the Triangle of Death. This is a triangle of three cities in Iraq, and there are raids and bombing on this area, and also communication is cut. So there is a kind of huge campaign or plan to bomb Iraqi cities wherever they think there is resistance. So we are really very worried about what's going to happen, because in these raids, in these bombings, the majority of people who are killed are civilians and houses and shops. So this has to stop.
Iman, do you think that it's a case of if you bomb the resistance, they'll stop their acts of resistance in the lead up to the election? Or is it the other way around? Should the resistance put down their weapons first and then the bombings will stop?
Since there is the occupation in Iraq, I don't think that the resistance is going to stop. Whatever the force, since there are foreign troops in Iraq, as far as there are foreign troops in Iraq occupying Iraq, there will be resistance. It is only logic. I mean, everywhere throughout history, where there is occupation, there is resistance. Until Iraq is free of the occupying forces, there will be always resistance.
Iman Kamis, formerly the director of Occupation Watch, joining us from Baghdad. Meanwhile, the UK Independent recently reported that the Pentagon says it's pursuing further investigations into war crimes in Iraq after last week's airing of disturbing cockpit footage taken from a US warplane. British television's Channel 4 aired video footage of apparently unarmed civilians being killed while walking down a road in Fallujah. This 30-second clip contains radio communication between the pilot and his air controller. This comes from Channel 4 in the UK.
I got numerous individuals on the road. Do you want me to take those out?
Take them out.
10 seconds.
Roger.
impact. Oh, dude.
During the exchange, neither the U.S. F-16 pilot or controllers asks whether the people were armed or posing a threat. Though the existence of the footage has been known for some time, the broadcast by Channel 4 News is believed to be the first time a mainstream broadcaster has shown the video. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandes. As voters went to the polls in Kashmir today for by-elections, turnout was low in the Kashmir Valley and 8 people were seriously injured as violence marred the day's voting. Police say separatist guerrillas triggered a landmine in an effort to scare people away from the polling booths. These actions, however, have some Kashmiris pointing out that in the ongoing unrest in the small South Asian nation, the Indian government itself has favoured a group of surrendered militants called the Ikhwanul Muslimin to fight their battles. In the mid-90s, this group managed to tilt the conflict in India's direction, becoming notorious for their terror tactics. Yet, as Shahnawaz Khan reports from Srinagar, today the Ikhwanis find themselves at the receiving end.
Over the years of armed insurgency in Kashmir, many voices have emerged, with demands ranging from uniting with Pakistan to independence from India. Towards the mid-90s, apart from fighting the Indian army, the militant outfits in Kashmir started fighting each other, with pro-Pakistan group Hizbul Mujahideen trying to dominate most of the groups. This infighting led one of the militant groups, the Jammu and Kashmir Ikhwanul Muslimin, or the Ikhwan, to join hands with the Indian army.
I was a member of the militant Kiwan ul Musalimin. I surrendered with my group as the Hizbul Mujahideen were troubling us and killed many innocent people in our village, so we joined hands with the army.
Maqsood Ahmad is an SPO or a special police officer with the Jammu and Kashmir government. Most of the Ikhwan activists are now enrolled with the government as SPOs.
Hizbul Mujahideen was a fierce group. They were not flexible and would kill people for minor mistakes.
While these men surrendered to save their skin, the Indian government used them to hilt to crush the militancy in Kashmir. Headed by Kukka Parve, they became the most dreaded people in Kashmir, roaming as unaccountable gunmen patronized by the army. Extortions and tortures were their hallmark. Maqbool Vire is a journalist from South Kashmir.
They killed Jamaat people, Jamaat Islami people, they killed HM people, they killed their brothers, their fathers, they burned down their houses. They were very rough, very, very, very hard, very harsh. Even innocents were tortured.
Maqbool remembers when he was dragged out from his office because he annoyed an Ikhwan commander with his news report.
I remember it was a land dispute, and the Ikhwanis were somehow involved. The Ikhwan commander was annoyed by my report about the matter. He was in Jammu, and rushed from Jammu to Srinagar, and sent some Ikhwan militants to my office. They dragged me down, abused me, beat me, and threatened me. They kidnapped me along with another journalist and kept us hostage for a day. They didn't kill me then, perhaps because I was a prominent journalist.
Many of the Ikhwanis have been killed by militants, including Kukka Parve. Today they assist the local police and security agencies. As SPOs, they are paid ₹1,500 a month, about one-third of a regular policeman. While the previous commanders of Ikhwan in South Kashmir are enjoying the wealth they have accumulated in these years, the lower-rank Ikhwanis are on their run. In the mid-90s, the Ikhwan tilted the guerrilla war in Kashmir in India's favor. Most of the Hithetto militant zones were neutralized. Afterwards, the militancy re-emerged in a different form, and the Ikhwanis became soft targets. Today, many of the Ikhwan activists have left the group. Some have joined militant ranks. Others have sought pardon from them. Those who could do neither continue to work with the government for a meager pay. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
Just weeks before the election, recent polls show Florida's Bob Graham's Senate seat is a virtual toss-up between Democrat Betty Custer, the former Florida Education Commissioner and USF President, and Republican Mel Martinez, the Cuban-born former Federal Housing Secretary. In 2002, Martinez was instrumental in advising the president to curtail trade and travel to Cuba, something that political observers say just might backfire. From Florida, FSRN's Mark Antokas files this report as we continue our one-month countdown coverage leading up to the November 2nd election.
George W. Bush has hopes that Mel Martinez will deliver the Latino vote in Florida, something the polls are not currently showing. Many of Florida's Latino communities say that just because a candidate speaks Spanish does not mean they are sympathetic to their needs. Jose Dadena, a Spanish-language video producer, says it's time to do something totally different and will be voting neither for Martinez nor Bush.
It's time that we try to do something totally different. Castro represents that. Castro represents someone that is open-minded, that is willing to admit that for 45 years we have carried a wrong policy toward Cuba, that something had to be changed.
Father Ramon is a Catholic priest from Cuba. He works with the Latino migrant workers in Florida. He is constantly monitoring the sentiment of the Latino community and says that Martinez is not being truthful in his portrayal of the situation on the island nation.
Well, I saw in the paper yesterday one declaration from Martinez. In Cuba, the child from 8 to 9 go to concentration camp. I don't see that. I was in Cuba last month. Children studying in the school is not concentration camp. That is a liar. And somebody who lies is not person to be in that position.
Martinez defends his position.
Unfortunately, the schools are not normal schools. They're school of indoctrination. And while they get an education, they also get a meager meal and very little parental contact, very little parental guidance, and I think that's just wrong. And that happens in Cuba today.
Patrick Mantegna, publisher of the Spanish and English newspaper La Gazeta, says that Martinez just doesn't see the real problems facing the Latino refugee hoping to stay in this country.
You know, he talks about his American dream, how he came over here, how this country accepted him. Well, this dream cannot be achieved by a Colombian child sent over here by their parents or a Venezuelan child or any other child. We send those children back.
Betty Castor is running as a Democrat for Bob Graham's Senate seat. Although recent polls have Castor and Martinez running neck and neck, the Republican Senate hopeful has not let up on what many see as negative advertising. Castor is realistic about her chances in pulling out the Latino vote.
I think that the Hispanic vote will be divided. I think the very conservative Cuban Hispanic vote in Miami will stay with him. But I think that the non-Cuban Hispanic vote throughout the state will in large measure come to me.
Many in the Cuban community see President Bush's policy towards trade with Cuba as one-sided. According to the Cuba Trade and Investment News, large companies such as Cargill Corporation, a large supporter of George W. Bush's re-election campaign, reap enormous profits by selling beef, wheat, poultry, and pork to Cuba. Sylvia Wilhelm of Fuentes Cubanos, a people-to-people group, which until recently was funded by the Treasury Department, was a Peter Pan kid. A Pedro Pan was a child which was smuggled out of Cuba in the early 60s by the Catholic Church, with help from the CIA. Fuentes Cubanos lost its license based upon presidential recommendations in 2002.
Even though I am a Cuban-American, even though I am a Pedro Pan, and I believe Mayor Martinez is also a Pedro Pan, I cannot fathom how he could want all of us to be separated from our families in Cuba. And that's why one of the big reasons I support Betty Castor.
Republican Congressman Jeff Flake.
People in Arizona and everywhere, I think, around the country realize this is an issue of freedom. And these sanctions are not doing much to curtail, to dampen Fidel Castro's willingness to put people in jail and do what he's always done.
Democratic Congressman Bill Delahunt of Massachusetts.
We find ourselves allied with regimes now that we provide assistance to whose human rights situation is worse than that in Cuba.
According to a recent Ben Dixon poll in Florida, for this coming presidential election, Republicans for the first time have lower numbers when it comes to new voter registrations. Independent voter registrations are up. For Free Speech Radio News, from WMNF in Tampa, this is Mark Antokas.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.